Hi, this is the last day of 2019. It is the December 31st edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. So how do you end a year? I think you end a year with a fabulous, fabulous find from 2019. And that fabulous find from 2019, Bob Henley. I have to tell you, Bob, I have to share with my audience, we're taping this show, everyone, on the 30th, but I called Bob this morning and I said, I think we were separated at birth. Every time I read what you write, I just keep going, oh my God, oh my God. It's exactly how I think. It's exactly how I would describe it. I would be writing it this way. Bob Henley has written and reported for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS Money Watch, and other outlets. He is now a reporter for The Chief Leader, covering public unions and the civil service in New York City. You can follow him on Twitter at Stuck Nation. You wrote a series of articles at Salon.com, and each one of them is a oh my God, I'm going to share this sentence. No, I'm going to share that sentence with my entire audience on Facebook, because you really do nail what I think we have been seeing, but nobody has articulated, Bob. And where I want to start is really how I want to start when I talk on C-SPAN on January 1st. You write, bad reporting on the economy is ennobling Trump. The economy is doing great, the mainstream media says. And Trump responds by slashing food stamps. Let's talk about this economy we are living in that everyone seems to celebrate, with the low unemployment and a stock market that's just off the charts. And, you know, all these incredibly wonderful things. And everyone I know around me is hearing this and not realizing that they're not alone because they're not experiencing it.
First, thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure.
It's great to do something like this with you. I think that looking forward to 2020, you know, words frame a debate, and definitions are what give words their power and meaning. So if we're looking forward to a transformational 2020, we really have to flip this script of the current winner-take-all pyramid. And that's really what we have in America, is a winner-take-all pyramid, where the Federal Reserve, not a Marxist front organization, reports that over 40% of American households have to scramble for a surprise $400 emergency expense. If it's a visit to urgent care, if it's an emergency car repair, consider that 137 million Americans are dealing with some form of medical debt that's stressing the family budget. Something like 25%, according to Gallup, of Americans have deferred an important medical treatment. So this is the circumstance we're in, but we're in a corporate news media that is selling luxury cruises and luxury cars.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to track this circumstance, and they don't want to empower what is a rising tide of the 99%, because they're doing very well by serving their paymasters at big pharma and big insurance.
So how do we, I mean, here's my question. Then what is the vehicle for letting people know about the economy they're living in? See, one of the things I think is that we've actually isolated people. We've isolated them from each other. We've isolated them from a narrative that would connect them with each other, that would make them understand they're not the only ones that are making these decisions about healthcare. They're not the only ones that are making this decision that they're going to have to rent for the rest of their life. They're not the only ones that have had to pay a credit card with another credit card. They're not the only. And there are so many things that tie the vast majority of Americans together. And it is not success. And it is not affluence, and it is not economic stability. It is, in fact, the opposite of all that. And yet, where is the vehicle for letting them know that you are not alone in this economic despair? What we need to do is figure out how to let them share their stories and then exercise the political clout to change the trajectory.
Well, I think part of it is that we have a system that runs on anxiety and shame. And so those things are, because we're in a circumstance where we see a dominant narrative that's driven by a certain kind of material accomplishment as a measurement of our success. And so we are in this atomized moment where we feel like certainly we're living in isolation. And so this is, you know, one of the things that, particularly in terms of what we're dealing with in terms of the mass media right now, to get a real sense of the circumstance of America, you have to go to what's left of regional newspapers. And so I did a piece, one of the Salon pieces you referenced. We look at the Alpine Motel fire in Las Vegas, where six people died because in that apartment complex, they keep themselves warm by putting their ovens on because the building is so substandard, their things were in chronic disrepair. 30 million American families are living in substandard housing this year, and in many cases putting children in danger. But you won't know that if you're not paying a granular kind of attention. And you have to be willing to speak your own truth. So if you're in an economically distressed circumstance, use that opportunity when you're interacting with people who are with debt collection or in some faraway boiler room in some other third world capital, having a conversation and using those moments of stress as a point of contact and empowerment for both yourself and the person you're speaking with. Well, that's just one small way of turning the tide.
So let me just say something. I have lived in an apartment where I've had to turn the heat on in the stove in order to heat my space and put my socks in the stove in order so when I would go to bed at night, my feet would be warm. And you want to know something? This is an absolute truth. This is the celebration of my lack of access to capital, my on the edge of edges when it comes to poverty.
Right.
Guess what I had? A microphone. And I was on the radio doing drive time in Nashua, New Hampshire. And I was telling my radio audience of what it was like, the size of the cockroaches in my apartment, the smell of the urine outside my door, and how cold I was because the heat was never, never working. All right. And I was on the air. And this is like 1999, Bob.
Right.
And let me tell you the power of that. People started calling me and dropping off blankets. People would call me up and say, you want to come stay at my house? And I remember saying to them, but will you take everybody else in the building with me? Okay, so part of it is that if we could tell the story, and the experience that Arnie had was on more microphones in America, was on more MSNBCs in America. When you told the story of not having access to health insurance and having your first baby born without health insurance, and suddenly you realize it isn't some person in another state, it's your neighbor, we would suddenly realize and we would empower each other to basically take hold of a system that is screwing us to the mat.
Well, and I think that if you look at, for instance, the conversation about how we discuss the Affordable Care Act, and sometimes it's treated in certain neoliberal circles like, you know, President Obama with Moses, and this was the tablets. You know, like, that you can speak no ill of ACA, but the reality is that the health care companies and Big Pharma were at the table. They made out like bandits. They continue to command an ever-increasing part of America's household income, and premiums and drug crisis have just skyrocketed.
Right.
And under the current occupant of the White House, if it was the Wild West before, it's a Star Wars bar now. And there is absolutely nothing in the way of late-stage social capitalism gobbling up everything that's not nailed down. And that's what's happening. And so when we have Democrats refer to, well, we have our private plans, and Americans are so covetous of their private plans. I don't know who they're talking to. I don't know who's covetous of their private health care plan, who doesn't think of it as a part-time job, heaven forbid, that they have to have some kind of medical procedure, and then have to have a forensic audit every time the bill comes.
The forensic audit. Oh, my God, I love you. So I posted on Facebook. Today I have been out of my mind. And every single time I post on Facebook, it's basically been a middle finger up in the air about insurance. So one of today's posts was the average insurance premium, just the premium. I'm not talking about the copay, the deductible, and the in-network and all that stuff. The average insurance premium for a family has increased 22% over the last 5 years, 54% 24% over the last 10 years, more than wages or inflation.
Right.
And I said, so you love your private health insurance? Now, let me remind everyone, this is with the ACA.
Right.
The tablets you were talking about.
Right. I mean, holy tablets already.
So,
yes, holy.
But see, this is, I think, the problem for 2020. In order to talk about health care, in some ways you have to trash a failure of the ACA. But if you trash the failure of the ACA, you're trashing Obama. You're trashing the incredible success of bringing more millions of people into the health insurance system, even though that was what we sold private insurance, so they would still make incredible amounts of money.
You're on a roll there, but here's the thing. It's kind of like battlefield triage. So you have a gaping wound, put a Band-Aid on it, and a few hours later, people are still marching, and the wound swallows the Band-Aid. Do you just keep marching because you really like the person that gave you the Band-Aid, or do you apply a tourniquet? And so that's where we are. Do we stop the bleeding now? And are we capable of the nuanced Tai Chi of saying, yes, President Obama acquitted himself with race and demeanor, but ACA was a giveaway to Big Pharma and the insurance company?
Yeah.
We can say both things, right?
What I can say is he didn't get to success. He may have moved the ball, but understand the ball he moved was only with permission from the people that were going to be making the fortune.
We call it terminal incrementalism.
Right, exactly. And you talked about Band-Aid. So I am on I'm telling you, I was on a roll today. So there was a story that I saw, and I was mentioning this on my radio show on Monday. Maine will consider a bill to cap insulin costs for diabetes patients, all right? So what we know is the cost of insulin has gone through the frickin' roof, and with so many people becoming more and more diabetic, in part because of health conditions, because of obesity, because of everything else, obviously the need for insulin has skyrocketed. But what I wrote is a Band-Aid, but not an answer. Please, please, let me keep my private health insurance, folks. This is what's killing us, is private health insurance. So when you look at this, that you would have to pass a law in a state to cap the cost of one thing, insulin, as if this is a solution for healthcare. And I keep thinking, well, what about my drug? Are you going to pass a bill about my drug next? What about my procedure? Are you going to pass a bill about my procedure next? As if this is a way to address the healthcare crisis, state by state, drug by drug, piece of legislation by piece of legislation.
Right.
Is this
insane? Look at the MS drugs. Piece I cited, it was between $8,000 to $10,000 in the 1990s. Now it's $80,000 a year.
Yeah.
So this is something where you're seeing, and I guess the thing here is that we really have to take back, you know, economy is from the Greek derivative, of course, of household management. So it's how we define household. And so one of the things we've seen is that really when the New York Times and the media, corporate media, talks about the economy, they're talking about the ability to make money with money.
Yeah.
That is not a measurement of the circumstance of the people in the country.
Right.
And those are increasingly two divergent things.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, many, many years ago when I was running for governor, I was running on the whole issue of property taxes. And I said, look, we're one of the richest states in the nation, the seventh richest state in the nation, but yet we have the highest student debt in the country. We have the lowest Medicaid reimbursements in the country. I went through every single – we contribute – we're like 50th in state aid to education. If you tripled our state aid, we'd still be 50th. How is it possible that on paper we can be so rich and yet for whatever reason we can't make any kind of requisite investments? And I remember telling the story that I lived in a little town of Orford, Bob, a town of 1,200 people, but a gazillionaire moved into town. We suddenly became a rich community.
Right.
Not because anybody got richer, but because when you income averaged everybody's income and you income averaged the one guy in town who had so many commas in his checks it would make your head spin, we suddenly became an affluent community and nothing changed.
Well, that is basically this disconnect between the abstract world of aggregate data. I mean, that's another thing that in the age of the internet, where we are, you know, sending more and more local reporters to the unemployment line and letting that void be filled by Facebook and whatever troll farm is available. What we're seeing is that there's, and this is part of the reason why Donald Trump was able to spin those 200 counties that had been voted for President Obama twice, 2008 and 2012. There's some odd 20 congressional districts, about 200 counties. And in those places, there was no recovery. And the mainstream media was surprised by this because, of course, on the New York to Washington corridor down in Silicon Valley, things have been great for people that are at the top end of the corporate media, driven place to place by chauffeured cars. The circumstance of the American people escaped their attention. So when you talk about unemployment numbers, no one lives in the aggregate. They live in a particular place.
Exactly.
And so in places in Ohio, and in places like in Michigan, you have, if you take a look at people that are struggling week to week, close to half of the population in these places are struggling week to week, have trouble making the rent. And this circumstance, because it's not curated, the households that we're interested in the corporate news media, are the ones that have disposable income.
Exactly.
That's the fixation. That's who they're speaking to. They're talking about the Viking cruise. Have you had the most luxury ever in your life? Well, here, we have another cruise for you. Like, that's who they're interested in. That's who they're having a conversation with.
But
the mass of folks who are struggling really aren't in that conversation. And that's why, you know, they talk about this. There is, every so often, like I say, there'll be some kind of great story buried in lifestyle section about somebody that's evicted with their children. But in general, we're disconnected from this, seeing our own circumstance reflected in the mass culture we consume.
Excuse me, can I offer one glaring example of exactly what you're talking about the aggregate? And that is, even when you listen to NPR News, which I used to think was actually covering the truth, they refer to the economy and how the economy is doing at the end of every newscast when they say, the stock market is doing X, Y, Z. The Dow Jones is up and the this and that.
As if the market
and I'm thinking,
is the economy.
You know, is that really speaking for 99% of Americans? It sure as heck doesn't speak for me. It doesn't make me able to pay my bills.
And yet the NPR.
That's how they define the economy. The economy is doing well. Donald Trump says so.
And we were talking about how do you critique the ACA and Obama without trashing him and recognizing that there was a bit of movement. But so I looked at a statistic the other day that we have the widest gap between rich and poor that we've had in the last 50 years. Okay. It is at the most extreme in 2019 than it has ever been. Now, I connected it to healthcare and the ACA, Bob. I posted on Facebook. You can tell I was just crazy this morning. Our healthcare system increases income inequality.
Right.
I said, even with the ACA payment structure of insurance, the income gap between rich and poor grows. To connect health care to a growing gap between rich and poor is something never do, but we must do it because it's the two lies. It's the two lies that need to be wedded together because they enhance each other.
Well, and there's a second one, which has to do with what's happened to student debt. So there's basically, and as you've been, you know, I've been speaking with you fairly on a regular basis now, I have been really focused on reporting on these aspects of the economy that really shape the reality people are in. And if we step back and look at what's really happening in terms of, well, we talked about the economy and households, we're deferring having children for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
But one of the things that's driving it, and I have daughters that are in this zone, is the huge debt albatross, $1.7 trillion, that's on this generation of young people who did what we asked them and went to college and now are buried in debt. And we've talked about this. Debt is social control.
Yeah.
And so
debt
you
is
have
social control.
A period
exactly.
of time where young people
exactly.
Should be finding the thing that they love to do that might inspire them, but instead they're settling for a job that can pay the bills. And so these are deferred dreams, and it's resulting in this really difficult problem with household formation, which really bodes poorly for a society that's about to have the baby boom, and we're in the midst of it now, where the social contract for the people that are hitting retirement age is coming due.
Yeah.
And we've killed the conveyor belt. That's the reality. The U.S. this question of capitalism as a conveyor belt that advances one generation and then another that follows, that is broken and it's not working.
But let's sort of compound it. So you have my daughter basically saying to me, my 35-year-old daughter, I'm not having children. I'm not having children, okay? That's your decision. My older daughter at this point still does not have children, and she's 37, okay? Right. I was having them when I was in my late 20s, and I was considered a late bloomer for waiting so long. I'm looking at my children clearly beyond that stage, and they're making the decision consciously, not only because of the fragility of their income state, but also because of the fragility of the climate condition. They're thinking, what right. am I bringing into the world? So you have those people not having children and delaying it or deciding not to. And then we are shutting down the immigration pipeline. We are going to see the lowest number of refugees ever since we've been taking refugees in 2020. The number is going to be absolutely ridiculous. So you're looking at this as well. And I'm looking at all those old people. I'm saying, who is going to pick you up out of bed? Who is going to put you in the tub? When your hands shake, who is going to put the spoon in your mouth? There will right. be nobody to do it. And then, again, we were talking about the stock market, and Ken was lamenting what he hears on NPR about how well the market is doing. So what I posted, again, on Facebook this morning, because I definitely was on a roll, stock market doing well? And I wrote, for whom? 2019, the top 1% owned right. 50% of all stocks. In 1980, the top 1% owned 39% of all the stocks. But this is the kicker. You were talking about the future. You were talking about the delayed decisions about owning a home, having a family, getting a job, all those things because they are so overwhelmed with that. Listen to this number. 79% of millennials own no stock.
Right.
Not one thin anything. And someone said to me, they haven't been taught how to invest. That was the answer on my Facebook page. How do we explain
that?
How do we explain to those morons that it's not about the fact that they don't know how to invest? You need something, as you pointed out, money to make money.
Right. Oh. Well, and I think that, we'd be remiss if we didn't include in this because what's been going on in a kind of our robo wars. I mean, you can't talk about $6 trillion being expended around the world over what's coming closing in on 20 years in a situation that has created all kinds of dislocation around the world, the largest refugee and migration crisis since the Second World War that was set all into motion by a response and then a reaction. And then, I mean, post 9/11, just look at the carnage. And the continuing destabilization of the world, a nation that was going to go have a war on terrorism, has proliferated it on a scale that it can't comprehend because the truth is just too awful. 6,000 suicides a year of American soldiers. Mm-hmm. I mean, countless numbers of civilian casualties. I mean, The Brown University study of the total cost of war, and we've taken our eye off that ball. I mean, the disintegration of the balance of power, as we hear about, that Donald Trump's on top of now, was building because for close to two decades, Congress was missing in terms of the proliferation of these armed combats to the point you saw what happened in Africa and Niger where they had Americans were killed, soldiers, and no less a person than John McCain said he didn't know there was a deployment there.
Well, but look at what just came out that has gotten no attention and probably won't in the next debate between the 2020 candidates,
right.
which is the Afghanistan papers.
Right, Washington Post.
The Washington Post. I mean, it is shocking, and they knew, and they kept hiding it. And when you look at the trillions we've spent and the money we have spent, it is just mind-blowing because just at the moment when we need to make those investments in order to stabilize us for an insecure future, we are blowing it. And not only did we blow it with the lies in Afghanistan, but as you pointed out, we have now basically sort of encouraged and massaged the kind of instability in the Middle East that we were basically claiming we wanted to stabilize. We've
right.
actually inflamed
and
that, it.
Right. If you look at the places now where things are teetering on the edge and there's a collateral damage in terms of the collapse of infrastructure, clean water, electrification, the things that are a structure upon which people can begin to get a basic modicum of public health. And at the same time, and this can't be said enough, we've had for 3 years in a row a decline in average U.S. life expectancy.
Right.
So this is, and that's why, 2020, we got to see perfectly, folks. We got to have the courage to look over our shoulder at what has been going on with fresh eyes. I mean, and I think we're feeling the urgency in the Sanders campaign, in the Warren campaign, in the engagement in general, particularly of young people running for office at all levels. Because for these young people, and we've said this before, their adult life is bookended by, in some cases, even before when they were teenagers and younger, 9/11, and then the Great Recession. So for them, that's the circumstance of the planet, and as you rightly say, hanging over all of it is a threat of climate change, which is already upon us.
Right. So your other piece is Salon.com. We're going to be going to break in a few minutes, but I want to just at least begin the conversation. You write a piece and you write, what strong economy? We've been talking a lot about the economy, that the market isn't the economy, that people don't have even $400 in case there's some sort of an emergency. You write, what strong economy? Healthcare costs are destroying American families. Can we afford universal healthcare? A mounting burden of medical debt suggests we can't afford not to have it. The idea, again, goes back to that connection that I was making, that now it is aiding and abetting the gap between rich and poor. It is not just about your lack of income. It is now the driver of health care. That health care is now, by definition, making us sick.
Right.
This is so important to say, Bob. Our healthcare system is making us sick. It is killing some of us. It is putting us into financial disrepair. It is making us more economically unstable. It is not fixing anymore as much as it is now undermining who
right.
we are. How do we talk about this? I mean, think about this. Even with everyone saying that, Medicare for all is extreme, as if what we're living now is not the worst of extreme.
Well, and I think you have to come back to looking at, again, unpacking this data point, the first time since World War I, the decline in U.S. average life expectancy. When you dig down into it, there's the whole opioid disaster.
Yeah.
That pharma was tied into and is trying to extricate itself from and playing that game you described before of one state off against
right.
another. I mean, what's been happening for a long time is that capital has been driving the conversation.
Yeah.
Right.
And it is particularly what you see, when you get to a point where the antidote for reform are reform-minded billionaires, you have to realize yeah. that the conversation is drastically skewed. And I do believe, though, that there is an opportunity to turn it around. And I do think that I see, particularly, as I said before, in the candidacy of so many young people at the local level across the country, there is something going on. I do believe it's transformative, and that's why outlets like yours are so essential.
So you write, and then we're going to go to a break. You wrote, but because of our national news prism is in the clutches of the corporate news media, which feeds off the ad revenue from big pharma and the healthcare industry, the real stories won't surface, even though the greed and corruption in both sectors is economically eating Americans alive and putting their actual lives in jeopardy. This, to me, that's the ad I want to see. I want people to hear this. This is a healthcare system that is actually doing the opposite of how it is packaged. It isn't here to help. It is here to undermine. It isn't here to give you access. Now you're trying to figure out how you can share one insulin shot. It's like when you begin, and there was I don't know if you got to see it, and at some point I have to really sit down and maybe look at it on YouTube. But MSNBC did something very interesting the other day. They played something called Red, White, and Who. And it was this young female comedian, went across the country to talk to Americans about health care. And she was, from what little I was able to see of it, because I was multitasking, Bob, it was actually very good. Because she basically showed the kind of pathetic joke our healthcare system is. You know, how unstable and insecure, and what people were doing, and how they were selling their houses and moving into RVs. And it wasn't an atypical story. It was a typical story. And it was happening everywhere. And it was like, who would want this system? You know, but I was, here's what was so sad, was that it's the last weekend of 2019, and they spent an hour doing this show that should have been played in 2010, in 2011, in 2012, that would have made it possible for us to have had the public option as a minimum, as opposed to what we got with the ACA. Instead, I feel like we've been living this dirty secret, even as it's been killing people and destroying families. I mean, how is that? I mean, I guess I don't understand what my party stands for. Maybe that's where I am. All right, we need to go to a break. This is the last day of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Parnes for 2019. Who did we choose to reach out to but the fabulous Bob Henley? We are just so lucky that not only does he write for papers in New York, but he's decided to write for Salon.com, and we get the benefit of his intelligence and his insight. We'll be right back.
And listeners, if you have not read everything that's been written by Bob Henley, you better get out there.
Exactly.
He's great.
Exactly. All right, we're going to go to a break. Welcome back to part two of the last edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes for 2019. We continue our conversation with Bob Henley. He has written and reported for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS Money Watch, and other outlets. Boy, you're so lucky. I wish I could say these things about myself. He is now a reporter for The Chief Leader, covering public unions and the civil service in New York City. You can follow him on Twitter at Stuck Nation. And because he decided to start writing for Salon.com, it gave us an opportunity to find out more about Bob. And we were talking a little bit about healthcare just before we went to the break, and about how it really is so destructive for American families. And I do think you were right. I think millennials are beginning to actually figure it out. I think they have that whatever is blinding them doesn't exist anymore, because they've had to live the reality. They've seen their parents struggle in a way that they realize that their parents' lives are different from their grandparents' lives. They can actually see that it, I mean, my children have seen it. My parents were so wildly successful. They had such great economic security. They had two houses. Do you know what they did for a living? They were public school teachers in New York City. And both their children went to law school. One became wildly successful where? Because he went to Wall Street. The other one chose not to go to Wall Street. And basically, what is it? It has been a story of living from paycheck to paycheck, living without health insurance, not being able to afford COBRA, having the most unstable life. And they can see within their own family what has happened. And then they look at their experience with the kind of debt they've been asked to accumulate, with the kind of lack of job opportunities, with a lack of affordable housing, with how sick they had to get and how frightened they were about being covered by some kind of health insurance. And just in their own generation of like 30 years, they've seen a decline that is dramatic. And I think maybe in some ways that is both their liability, but maybe it is also our political gift, because they will understand that that needs to change.
Yeah, I think that one of the things that's happened is that it's now become, I think, widely understood by economists that the United States is no longer a mobile society, right, as you describe, which is this ability of one generation to create through investment in their children the circumstance for their children to advance and do better than their parents did.
Right.
The data is pretty clear on that increasingly in America, your zip code is your destiny. Mm-hmm. And so that was really the moral raison d'etre of capitalism and informed by democracy. I do think that coming out of what happened with the USSR and the United States appearing to best the USSR,
right,
there was a kind of notion that capitalism itself was just, you know, the utopia, you know, and so we were blinded to its excesses. And we then saw, of course, what happened with this kind of vulture capitalism devouring what was left of the USSR public assets and turning into a kleptocracy, which gave rise to Putin and the petri dish out of which Donald Trump sprang.
Yeah.
And so that, I think that's an important thing. I don't think we really have looked at the way that this, as I said before the break, that this conveyor belt is broken. And so as the social contract that came with that is somewhat in tatters. And I would only reflect on the experience of, you know, people that I know who are in their 80s, who went to places like City College for free. Like, if you look at when the United States historically invested in free higher education, tremendous wealth was created. Because when we invest in people, they go on to invest in others. It works. And if you look at what's happened in the world where in China, where they invested in higher education in people who had capability, there was this tremendous upward mobility. Of course, they're oppressive and they're finessing dictatorship to a frightening level. But the reality is that investment in human capital is the best long-term economic development tool that there is. And what we've done instead here is turned it into a scarcity model. And I tell you, I fear that this is becoming clearer and clearer by the day. Had we taken that $1.7 trillion in a tax cut that went to corporations and instead directed to retiring student debt, we would have the kind of growth that I'm talking about that would have been broad-based and sustainable in our communities.
Yeah.
As opposed to just in, you know, the C-suite.
Well, you wouldn't have picked winners and losers. Because we would all be winners. Because when you see how the student debt, I mean, if you put a map of the United States, it's everywhere. It's in South Dakota. It's in Kentucky. It's in New York. So by basically releasing these people from the burden of student debt, the choices you get, the dreams that you unleash, the ability to have a family, the idea, I mean, to start out with $40,000 of student debt that will only compound means that you are delaying all these choices. And you are absolutely right. It would be the most amazing economic juggernaut that would have made the rich richer. This is the most amazing.
Right. One of the things,
by the way, $40,000 of student debt is a low
amount. Number. Right. Keep going.
And I would say also that one of the problems here is that it is such a an albatross in the sense of, in the first 10 years of my career, I was working, I was able to stick with journalism because I did other things.
Right.
But when you're able to keep the cost of living down when you first start out as an adult, you can pursue things that don't necessarily aren't, you know, financially remunerative right away, but you're making an investment in yourself and in your skill set.
Right, exactly.
When you have a situation where there's no period of apprenticeship, where you have to immediately just look for the short-term thing of how much money can I make right now,
exactly,
you begin to internalize the psychotic nature of the market itself.
Exactly right. Well, and see, the irony of what we would have been talking about is that we already know that the rich are sitting on mountains and mountains of cash, that they already have access to so much. The irony is they would have been even richer if they had made that investment instead of giving them this tax cut. Because in the end, the tax cut really didn't grow the kind of economy you were just describing and I am just describing. And the kind of economy we're describing would have made them, even over the long term, richer. They were so short-term focused. They looked on tomorrow and they didn't look on next year. And they could have made out as well. And we all would have made out.
Well, I think, you know, I had in 2015 when I was at CBS Money Watch, I had when President Trump, then Citizen Trump, floated down the staircase at Trump Plaza. He had a press conference on, I should get you the tape, it's actually kind of funny exchange.
Yeah.
He came down to lay out his tax policy, and he was talking about something I've written about a lot, which is the trillions of dollars in stranded offshore assets. That's this thing that happened to the United States where through the magic of LLCs, limited liability corporations, companies are able to put their assets and their resources and revenues offshore, book them offshore in places that have actually nothing really to do with their business model except that they agree to stash the cash, right?
Right.
This
the Cayman Islands and a post office box.
Time.
Yes.
Trump came down and announced his policy, and I said, you know, this is very familiar. I asked Trump directly, this is something that George W. Bush tried, and it was a disaster. All the money ended up going into the pocket of CEOs and stock buybacks. And he said this one would be different because of the scale. And I said, well, have you thought about at least requiring that they just do something basic for this tax cut, like, say, pay their interns a living wage?
Yeah.
And he kind of fumfered at that, and I got a laugh in the audience. It was unusual going up against Trump. But that is the reality, that this thing he talked about doing didn't really do that. So now what's happening is they're still keeping the cash offshore. They are still. This is really the perverse part of this late-stage vulture capitalism, is they stash their cash offshore and then borrow money here in the United States. So they rack up corporate debt, they squeeze out venture capital from startup firms, hog all that money while they keep this treasure trove offshore. And, of course, the reality is that they're only able to do this because of the United States military expenditure, which creates this stability in the world where they can stash this money offshore.
Yeah.
So this is the system that, you know, you hear, I mean, I have to say, I hear Bernie Sanders addressing it. Elizabeth Warren, I don't hear so much getting into the defense critique. But there can be no discussion of the macroeconomic circumstances of this country without discussing about this globalization of wealth and the military-industrial complex.
Absolutely, absolutely. So it's so interesting you just bring up Bernie, because I went to Salon.com, and this is not your article, but it's fascinating, the title. The
right.
title is The Bernie Blackout Appears to Be Over. How will the media cover this? Now, this is it's so perfect, because this is the shocking thing of 2015 and 2016. And you've heard me tell this story before. Bernie comes to my house in 2015, January of 2015. Everyone knows him as the sort of the Democratic Socialist from Vermont, the independent. He's never been a Democrat, okay? He made caucus with them, but he's never been a Democrat. And he calls me up and he says, I want to borrow your living room. And I said, why? He goes, I'm thinking of running for president. I start laughing. I live in Concord, New Hampshire. So obviously New Hampshire is like a place that you want to show up. And I said, sure. I said, I'll push aside the furniture. I'll put out water, but that's all I'll do because I'm in the media. He shows up at the house, okay, in 2015, January, and 150 people show up. I'm kind of shocked. I'm like, who knew that Bernie knew 150 people in New Hampshire? I mean, we don't care about what's going on in Vermont. He gets up and he does his dog and pony show, everything he's been saying since 1980. You know, we could all give his speech, especially you and me, Bob. So when he gets up there and gives a speech, and I've heard it before, and it doesn't excite me in some ways because I've heard it before, but I'm watching everyone in the room going, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. So he's clearly connecting with the audience. And so when he gets done, I raise my hand. And he says to me, Arnie, what's the question? And I said, you haven't answered the $64,000 question. He said, what's that? I said, which party?
Mm-hmm.
And you can hear a pin drop, Bob. And he doesn't answer. And the room gets like, you hear this gasp in the room. All right? And I said, I'm going to be a real jerk, Bernie. If you don't pick a party, you may want to leave the house. I said, because people are here for a conversation and not a solo performer. And then he gets really quiet, and for probably the first time ever, he says, I believe I will run as a Democrat. And then here's what I do, Bob. I get quiet, and I smile, and I put my arm around him, and I say, it's hard for me to say it sometimes, too. Okay? But the reason I bring this up now is that this is where he shocked everyone, because the story that the Democrats never allowed out, the conversation that was never permitted, the idea that it was too extreme, it turned out that there were so many people within the base of the party that knew that what he was saying was what they were living. That
right.
understood that that we had pissed away billions of dollars on the military-industrial complex with no result and an increase in terrorism. That we saw what was going on with healthcare. That we saw what was going on with the lack of the ability to organize. That we saw what was happening with minimum wage. That these were all – and he did it with an emotion and a vigor. And he did it in the context of a Democratic primary at a time when they basically ignored him in the beginning. And now it is 2019, and what is the headline? The media can't ignore him now. My God, what has he had to do to prove that what he was saying had a base and resonated, despite the fact that mainstream media has built up walls to prevent it from being heard?
Well, and of course, they have done so much to keep Uncle Joe up. You know, like it reminds me of a prize fight where the guy's in the ropes with an army holding him up. They, you know, he was speaking, I guess Eugene Robinson referred to Vice President Biden's word salad. He does seem to have gotten some clarity of thought. But even now, I was just, you know, reading before we got together, this whole business about Vice President Biden at first saying that he wouldn't honor a subpoena, then he would. I mean, again, this is all looking in the rearview mirror. And we can't afford a glance backward at this point.
Exactly.
We really have to look forward. And there are so many things that have to be done all at the same time that it's kind of like the 21st century version of Rubik's Cube. You have to expand the economy at the same time of healing the planet.
Yeah.
And so that's going to require some kind of deep thinking and a kind of new unselfishness that is very uncharacteristic for the way the corporate news media has been driving the conversation. I mean, we have had this very strange, and it's interesting. I write a lot about labor unions, and one good development this past year as a chief leader after, since 1897, we were doing public unions. This year, we started covering the entire labor movement. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I'm stunned by is, you know, we are still in a situation where the federal minimum wage is $7.25.
Yes.
And there's no place in America that you can live and have a place, a shelter, that for $7.25. And so the reality here is that we're in a situation where idle capital, that's just capital that's hanging around, investment capital, is given much better treatment than people that are working for $7.25 an hour. And so we've seen over the arc of the last 20 years, corporate income taxes as a share of what's being brought into the pool shrink. And we've seen the tax burden increasingly falling on the people that can least afford it. And that's the status of where we're at now. And that's because we've had a situation where big capital has bought both parties.
All right.
And that's where we are.
So that actually is my segue. My segue to the idea of billionaires and money and capital buying both parties. So let's talk about Mayor Bloomberg's acquisition of the Democratic Party and the amount of money he's already spent on ads, which exceeds all the ads spent by all the other 19 or 22 or whatever number of candidates there were. And his ability to use the connections he's made as the former mayor of New York City, his ability to have spent money in very, very interesting ways on issues of climate, on issues of guns, on issue of health care, public health, of course, and obviously having a media empire called Bloomberg. So how is Mike going to do, given the fact that we have all this unhappiness that was exposed by the Bernies and the Elizabeths to some extent, and yet Mayor Bloomberg, he's interesting because he taps a piece of that unhappiness, but yet I feel like he will be incapable of making any of those results because the most important thing is that he reminds his very wealthy friends, it's okay with me. You'll be fine with me. And as long as it's fine with him and fine for them, then it can't change and we can't improve and the system continues to rot.
I think that my comments are based on having covered him every day for the three terms that he was in for WNYC. And so there's a kind of granularity to this, my appreciation of him, that comes from the fact that he did make himself available on a regular basis, at least three times a week, sometimes four, to reporters for general questions. I have had some time with him, just engaging him one-on-one over the years, and part of it comes from his own Horatio Alger story, which is authentic, unlike that of Mr. Trump.
Right. No,
his father died early. He parked cars to work his way through school. He had the good fortune of getting a great job on Wall Street, Salomon Brothers, and then got laid off from the great job. But he was so good at what he did, they gave him $10 million to go away. And from that, he created this global financial news empire. He really believes that everybody that's somewhat capable can succeed like he has succeeded. He does have that sense, and he is somewhat blind to some of the structural issues that exist for so many other people. And so that manifested itself with the thing, probably the greatest stain on his tenure, which was the huge explosion of stop and frisk, which it stopped under, which it started under Giuliani, but really exploded during Mayor Bloomberg's tenure in New York City, where at one point they were stopping hundreds of thousands of young men of color. Only 4% of those encounters were resulting in any kind of arrest. And that really created a great racial divide in the city. And during the time that he was there, there was a whole kind of turning New York City into a luxury good, where housing that had been working class neighborhoods that were places that people who were, you know, working class folks could afford, all of a sudden they got, you know, priced out of. Right. And so you had a situation where all of a sudden you had oligarchs and fallen dictators and folks that had needed places for a place, needed a place to park money, putting their money into these luxury properties in New York City, which really transformed the real estate and created this explosion in homeless. And that this kind of feudalism that played out was part of the Bloomberg legacy. That said, he did decide that, you know, smoking wasn't good in bars and took this stand that people said would destroy the hospitality industry. And it became, since then, the idea of a smoke-free environment became the global standard, and it actually helped the industry. There is a commitment that he has to climate change that's sincere, and he has done this thing of empowering mayors across the country to fight the gun lobby and the NRA. But this, the scale of his wealth and how he came to get all that wealth through this global enterprise needs to be part of the conversation. And while he was mayor of New York City, he did not disclose the federal taxes he paid, and I have not seen him do that yet. So that's going to be the big challenge yet ahead for Michael Bloomberg, if he's going to really lay claim to being a different kind of billionaire than the current phony billionaire in the White House. He must disclose his federal taxes.
I want to ask you, you were talking about the displacement of working class people from housing in New York to be converted into luxury housing. When I lived in Manhattan about 20 years ago, 25 years ago, it was poor people's housing and people of color who were being displaced by gentrification and luxury housing. So I'm wondering, is this a trend that this is the way it occurs? First, the poor people get pushed out and the people of color, and then the working class, and pretty soon it's just, as you said, a luxury playground.
Well, and I think the artists are always, you know, folks that find value where it's dodgy and infrastructure is challenged. We have that. And so, yeah, I think it is an escalating thing. It's like physics, and the more and more that the equation is skewed towards wealth, the more and more it continues to be skewed to wealth until we use our system to right-size our circumstance. And this is upon us right now. That's what 2020 has to be about.
But, you know, and so I guess I'm going to end with this. So will the impeachment hearings that we're going to be faced starting in January, will they aid and abet a conversation we need to have, or will they be exactly the kind of distraction the GOP and Donald Trump want? Because God forbid we talk about what we've been talking about. That takes time. It takes reinforcement. We obviously have a mainstream media that doesn't see a financial benefit in having these conversations. They love covering impeachment. Impeachment is good for their bottom line. But all these things that we're talking about, not so much.
Well, I guess looking at the narrative here is that what could happen if the idea of the Trump prosperity is encountered, we could see a situation where it plays out where he's acquitted by the Senate and then claims the mantle that's been polished for him by the corporate media about the great economy. Yeah. And that would be the scenario that I would be concerned about. So that's why it's critical to move on two fronts. To bring focus and scrutiny to the process of impeachment. To when you see Moscow Mitch being obstructionist, why isn't it that they want to have due process? But at the same time, digging down and bringing to the fore and to the national forum the stories of struggle and isolation that exist in flyover country, coast to coast, the America, the corporate media continues to ignore. And that work, that's key. And we can do both things at the same time. I think I'm up for it. What about you?
But how can we get more exposure? As you said, radio stations like ours that are independent offer a service, but we don't reach a lot of people, and the mainstream media do, and they're not interested in covering this. So
yeah,
how do we get that out to
there are ways.
So people listen to Bernie and Elizabeth?
Tapping into this network of national candidates that are running at the grassroots level.
Right.
That I mean, the pieces I've done on Salon continue to do well weeks after they've been posted.
Exactly.
And that's all the work of constant social media and reaching out and connecting. And then I find so many new stories about obscene things going on in the country because of this network.
Exactly. No, you're absolutely right. And again, I'm going to go back to another article at Salon.com that was written probably mid-December. And it says, after impeachment, Trump wins again unless Democrats can tell a better story. And what you are describing is the better story. This is the better story. The better story that literally does say the economy he's talking about is not the economy you live. You know, the healthcare that he's talking about, he's going to fix, of course, he's never come up with a solution, is a healthcare that really is now dismantling the stability and the safety of this economy. I mean, I think this is the narrative, but we have to get them all on the same page. And my fear is that Joe Biden, who is running in place, will not be willing to share that narrative. Mayor Pete, who's kind of now a younger version of Joe Biden, is continuing that conversation about the status quo. I mean, he talks about change, but nothing he says is change. That's the part that's shocking.
Right.
Just because he doesn't have facial hair and he looks young doesn't mean that what he's delivering is change. Because every time he says the word change, I wait and there's nothing there. And I keep thinking, so you've got those two candidates doing that, which in a lot of ways are reinforcing the ultimate message that will be coming out of Donald Trump.
I hate to say this about another icon of the Democratic Party, but, you know, Pete Buttigieg not only looks like JFK, his talking and sounding like he really is inspiring and exciting and new, but actually having no substance there, no change there, just really supporting the status quo. I mean, he's JFK Jr.
Yes.
Well, I think actually in a Democratic administration, he would be great Secretary of Housing and Urban Development, and then he could do those things that he almost got to do and finish where he was mayor.
When he was mayor. On that note, it is our last show of 2019. What a way to end. We end with Bob Henley, who has written and reported for The Village Voice, Pacifica Radio, WNYC, CBS. Actually, what's great is he hangs out with us. I think that's his greatest compliment.
We are very lucky.
We are very lucky. Thank you so much.
Happy New Year.
And have a wonderful 2020. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes.
Light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. This little light of mine, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my home, I'm gonna let it shine. All in my room, I'm gonna let it shine. Shine, the road is dark, the way was long, kept on singing that freedom song. My God promised me a rainbow sign, just gotta let my little light shine. Don't give up, don't back down, don't let the liar turn you around. My heart's fixed, made up in mind, I'm going out and let my little light shine. Sure gonna let my little light shine. All in the streets, I'm gonna let it shine. On the battlefield, I'm gonna let it shine. See, now I ain't gonna fight no rich man's war. That ain't what God's gonna use me for. Killing folk ain't in my line. Sure ain't no way to let my little light shine. Shine on me, shine on me. Let the light from the lighthouse shine on me.